Let us all sit down together for a few minutes. All of you may sit as you feel comfortable. We will start our discussion, and if anybody wish, you can also keep your eyes open. Everybody hear me at the back? You can hear me? At the age of 80, the Buddha was passing away in India. And before he died, 3 months earlier, the Buddha told everybody that in 3 months' time, I'm going to pass away. And then Buddha walked 3 months and he said, in a place called Kushinara, I'm going to die there. So he mentioned this to his close disciples so that they spread the message that the Buddha is passing away so people can come and pay their last respect to the Buddha. And in a place called Kushinara, the Buddha, of course, after 3 months of walking, village to village, teaching, the last moments, teaching, he came to this place. And of course, Buddha was born under the tree. And Buddha spent all his life in open nature. And then Buddha got enlightenment under the tree. And then Buddha also was lying under the tree to pass away. At the age of 80. So monks from all over India, monks, lay people, they came in hundreds to pay their last respect to the Buddha, the great master, is passing away. So Buddha's cousin, he's called Venerable Ananda. In a modern day term, you can say he was the secretary to the Buddha, personal attendant. So he was organizing the people. Hey, line up, all of you line up, queue up. All of you get a chance to pay your respect to the Buddha. And you know in India, the queue system. Wherever there is queue, there has to be elbowing, pushing, shouting, jumping, breaking, all this. India is India. We have a good high tradition. Anyway, the same tradition was there, queuing up, people lining up. And one monk comes, barging he comes. Of course, he was a sadhu of those days. And he comes and says, I want to talk to Buddha, very urgent. And Venerable Ananda says, hey, what are you saying? Look, Buddha is passing away. In few minutes he is going to die. How can you talk to Buddha now? The last moment. He says, nothing doing. I have to talk to the Buddha. Move. And he is, of course, very highly respected monk, Venerable Ananda. He was older. And he tried to convince him, look, please, stand in queue. You get a chance. But you can't talk to the Buddha. There are so many people in line. No chance. Sorry. Please stand in queue. You just pay the last respect to the Buddha. He's dying. But he insists. He was shouting, no, I have to talk to the Buddha. And then Buddha hears this conversation. Buddha overheard this conversation that this man is insisting to meet him. Buddha had this capacity, of course, many people, you also can have it, this capacity to read others' mind or to know what he's thinking. But don't worry, I don't know. Don't worry, so you can relax, I don't know. Anyway, this power Buddha had, so immediately Buddha understood this person is ready. Ananda, let him come. And he went to the Buddha. And his question to the Buddha at that time was, he said, look, he was insisting, he said, I have to talk to the Buddha because I don't know when Buddha dies what you people will teach. I want to hear directly from his mouth. So he went to the Buddha. And he asked the same question which many of us also have many a times. Many of you come to Ladakh, come to India, go to Rishikesh, go to Varanasi, go to Shravasti, go to this, many places, you go to South India, that India, and then you learn yoga, you learn this, you meet this Baba, you meet this sadhu, that sadhu, everybody says, you know, this is the teaching. Same question this monk asked the Buddha. He says, look, in this vast country, all teachers are saying, look, my teaching is right. Look, my teaching is right. My teaching is shortcut to Nibbana, liberation. And all teachers are saying, I'm the right teacher, I'm the right guru. And he asked Buddha, how do I know which is the right guru, which is the right teaching? Because everybody is saying, I'm right, I'm right, I'm right. And Buddha says, full of compassion, he says, look, any teacher that teaches the middle path, not the extremes, the middle path, any teacher that teaches the middle path is the right teacher. Any religion that teaches the middle path is the right religion. And Buddha says, now you go and look. Which is right, which is the right guru, which is the right teacher for you. Go and look. And many of you also come to India, do the same thing, go to this guru, go to that religion, go to this religion, so many religion, and then come back home totally spiritually cocktail. What to do now? Which one to practice? Which is right? Which is that? This Baba convinced you, that sadhu convinced you, this Vivek in Ladakh convinced you, so many convincing, you come back home totally confused, which is right, which is wrong. Now why Buddha says middle path? Understand. Buddha, when he first started teaching, same thing he said when he gave the first teaching and when he died also, whole life he taught the same thing, middle path. Don't go to extreme, middle path. When Buddha started teaching for the first time to the 5 disciples, his first word that the Buddha uttered, he said, friends, avoid 2 extremes. Follow the middle path. What are these 2 extremes? Buddha says, kamesu kamasukkali kanu yogo. That means, indulgence in sensual desire. Extreme indulgence in sensual desire is one extreme. And then the other extreme is atta kilamatanu yoga. That means atta means self, kilamatanu means destroying the self, torturing the self in the name of spirituality. These are the two extremes. Why he said indulgence in sensual desire is one extreme. Because Buddha, when he lived as a prince all his life, he was only indulging in all sensual desires all the time, pleasing all the senses, hearing all beautiful sensual things and seeing and all kinds of sensual desires. Extreme. Buddha says this is an extreme. This does not bring happiness, this does not bring inner peace, inner joy. Remember, this is an extreme. Another extreme was attachilamatanu, that means self-mortification, destroying the self. How? In those days in India, there was a belief that if you want to attain the truth, look, when you see with the eyes, impurity starts arising, destroy the eye. That was the belief. You hear, you destroy the ear. Your hand is doing unwholesome actions, bad actions, you cut the hand. All these extreme practices were there. And this extreme, both extremes, is very apparent in today's society also. Artha Kilamata, the best example of this self-mortification, torturing the body in the name of spirituality, in the name of searching for the truth, in India, is so widespread, even today. So if you visit some of the temples in India, even today you will see one sadhu, he keeps his hand like this for the whole day. And then you see one more sadhu, he has a bed of thorns, bed of nails, and he's standing there for the whole day. That's all. And then there is one sadhu, he goes out completely naked. Complete naked. He believes that by complete naked, body suffers. If it's cold, it's cold. If it's hot, it's not protected. So he's purifying. This extreme belief is there in India even today. And if you want to see some more extreme, I keep telling people, go to India during one of this festival. It's called Kumbh Mela. Kumbh Mela is the Olympics of the sadhus and the babas. That's the time when they display what powers they can do and all kinds of things. They cut, make a hole in the hands, cut here, cut there, put a rod from here to here, a rod through the tongue. All kinds of torturing the body takes place. And that is what the Buddha calls it, one extreme. Another extreme, Buddha says not to harm or hurt. For him it was very clear, middle path, not to harm or hurt any living beings which is visible to human eye, which is not visible to human eye. How can you kill or how can you destroy, which you cannot see? But extremists, they take another path. My goodness, when I breathe, lot of bacteria goes in, cover your mouth. So we have one tradition in India, they cover their mouth all their life, not to kill, because when they eat or maybe breathe from the mouth, they say, oh, we are killing so many living beings. This is another extreme. Buddha says, these are extreme, keep it aside. Now, sensual desire extreme, 21st century is a perfect example of this extreme of sensual desires. You look at any angle, sensual desires all the time, and Buddha says, where does this sensual desire arise? Wherever there is more of pleasing things to the senses, all these sensual desires start coming up. One example. Supposing if you go, which you go, of course, maybe going quite often, to this huge shopping mall. There is not a single thing in the shopping mall which you will say, I don't need this. There is hardly anything. And moreover, some products, they keep a small television there, saying that you need this, if it's not very convincing. They convince you to say this, you need this. Because the consumer society is designed in such a way, so pleasing. You look at this towel, you want to buy it. You look at this soap, so smell nice, I want this. You look at this toothbrush, you have so many brush at home. And you look at this toothbrush, because it has a little bit twist at the end, or it has a little bit more grip, you say, wonderful brush, I need this brush nowadays, you buy it. You have wonderful pen at home, full box of pen, you see this pen, it has a light at the back or front, I don't know, looks like a torch. And then you say, oh, I need this, you know, who knows, maybe I'll write in the night and I will need it. All these sensual desires are full. And because this is, Buddha called it extreme, we all see it, that this extreme does not bring inner peace, inner happiness. If this was to bring real peace and real happiness, mind you, all the so-called developed countries would be so full of joy and happiness. No tension, full of tension free. But it is the other way around. Wherever there is less of these pleasing things, there is less of tension in the mind. Why? Supposing you, many of you, if you visit India, there are some villages, it's amazing to see India, so many villages, there is a big city, metropolitan city with all these latest technologies, skyscrapers, shopping malls, big, and you just walk maybe 5-10 minutes, you come to this village, they don't even know what notebook is. They still use wooden blocks, you know, to write. Still now, just next to this metropolitan city. And they seem to be so happy with their wooden block. No worries of the notebook, this notebook. And nowadays, how many notebooks kind? For mathematics, square. And for English handwriting, 4 lines. And then for another language, single line. What complication. These boys, they have just one slate. Whether you write English, mathematics, it's the same thing. So the more there is of all this extreme of sensual desire, the more there will be suffering. This is Buddha's words. And that is why Buddha, having seen this as a prince, he lived all this. He had a summer palace, autumn palace, winter palace. We don't have summer house, winter flat, this flat, but it's okay. We have all this technology to turn into this. Those days probably they didn't have that technology. But anyway, we have to understand what Buddha wanted to say was, indulging in extreme sensual desire does not bring happiness. And if there are many beliefs also, there are many beliefs, even spiritual beliefs, that if you go in extreme sensual desires, you also attain spirituality. There are also beliefs like this. I was discussing with my brother, who is a very high, one of the topmost Buddhist scholars, Tibetan Buddhist scholars. So he was teaching this mandala meditation to one lady. So he asked me if I could interpret this. I said, okay, sure. So he started like this. If you want to meditate on this mandala, if anybody here is following Tibetan Buddhism, don't feel offended. I'm just telling my experience. Fact is fact. There is a meditation on mandala. I don't know if you are familiar with mandala. Mandala is a sand drawings that the Tibetans do, and in the center they believe that you pray and meditate on a deity. So each mandala has a different deity. And if you really want to pray to this deity, he was explaining, and his explanation was, I was shocked. But anyway, he was explaining, so I had to translate this to this lady. He said one of the most important criteria to practice this meditation, interesting, is that you must indulge in sexual intercourse. And the sexual intercourse is a special intercourse, according to him. When a man has sex with a woman, he should be able to withdraw his, the sperm into his body and not live in the woman's body. If you can do that, then only you can practice this meditation. I thought, oh no, this is not my cup of coffee, maybe for you, but not for me. And then suddenly that lady said, can you practice this for me? To my brother. And he was full of red, you know, what can you practice? He said, no, I don't practice now. It is all ancient practice. Now we don't do, nobody practices this. But there are beliefs that if you, there are beliefs in spirituality, of course the world is crazy, that if you, what Buddha says, extreme indulgence, they say through this indulgence you have to come out of. That is the belief. But Buddha went the other way around when he says the middle path. And this middle path is very clearly defined by the Buddha. Buddha never left anything without explanation. Buddha always explained very, very clearly. And Buddha used the language called Pali. Pali was the language of the common people. Everybody could understand this language. Otherwise in religious, in this, you can see in many of the spiritual or religions, there are always two languages. One is the normal language which I and you can understand. But then there's another language. Only the spiritual, like the high spiritual people can understand. I cannot understand. And the funny thing is, in our tradition of belief, they say, when somebody teaches, if you don't understand, that is the real teaching. If you understand everything, that's not the teaching. So in, ironically, in our place, let's say Dalai Lama comes to teach. We all go, the whole Ladakh people from all over Ladakh go and listen to his teachings. I tell you, 90% of the people does not understand what he's saying. And you go to the English translation, I tell you, if you understand even half or less than half, congratulations.
Maybe 5%.
It is very difficult. But the Ladakhis, of course, you might not say, oh, we didn't understand his teaching, very unfortunate, you know, it's very deep or whatever. You might argue and convince yourself like this. But the traditional belief is, you know, we have a word called sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That means, oh, excellent, excellent. We didn't understand anything. Excellent, excellent. Such is the complexity what we have made. But Buddha's teachings was made very clear in the language of the common people. Buddha didn't have this two double standard language. He didn't have. He had only one standard language, and that was Pali, in the language of the common people. Anyway, what Buddha explained was, his middle path was Sila, Samadhi and Panya. That's all. When we talk about meditation, please understand, meditation does not mean just meditation, one word. Meditation means three things. Sila, Samadhi and Panya. That means what? Sila means morality. If you have no morality, there is no meditation. Meditation has no pillars then. Samadhi means concentration of the mind. Developing the concentration of the mind. If this is not there, meditation is not there. Panya means wisdom. Mere wisdom, without these two, you can't have wisdom. So you can't call it meditation. So meditation in the Buddha's explanation is Sila, Samadhi and Panya. Then only it is meditation. Now, we have been here for the whole day. Some of you are new, some of you, most of you have been into meditation. We have come here for, usually I tell people, whenever you come to a retreat or whenever you come to a meditation like this, what are we trying to do? We are trying to build a house of meditation. And now if you are to build a house, we need a very strong foundation. Otherwise, you can't build a house. But if some of you insist, which happened in India also, you can build a house without foundation. They were insisting. I mean, I could also insist and say, I can build a house without foundation. I bring all these mud bricks from Ladakh, I mean, in Ladakh, and I start building. I can paint blue, red, yellow, the window is like this, beautiful curtains and everything. It looks so beautiful house, no difference between my house and the other house. You can build it. But the thing is, one slight storm comes, your house collapses. One slight wind comes, your house will collapse because the foundation is not there. And moreover, in Ladakh, all the bricks are mud bricks. If you put water, it just melts. You can't build a house. Many people also insisted in the history of Indian spiritual history that you don't need a foundation, yet you can build a spiritual house. This was the belief in India, and many people tried. And they fell, collapsed. Buddha said, you can't build a house, you can't build a strong house without the foundation. Anyway, if even in meditation, if you believe, or if you are practicing without a foundation, you might seem to be meditating so well, sitting like this and not moving like exactly like replica of Buddha statue. It might appear, but understand, the foundation is not there. Even one slight wind or a storm comes, you will collapse. And what is this foundation? Very strong foundation. Remember, when Buddha taught, 99% of the old people who were listening to Buddha were people like us, who are having social responsibilities, families, all kinds of livelihood. We were common people like this, 99. Only one person were there, hardly few thousand people were there, who were monks and nuns, who were listening to him. But majority of the Buddha's disciples were normal people like us, which indicates very clearly that the Buddha's teaching is not for monks and nuns, which was the belief for a very long time. In Burma, in the early 1850s only, meditation was brought into the life of common people. Until then, it was purely for monks and nuns, not for common people like us. There was only one teacher whose name is Lady Siado. He was the first teacher in the, modern day century, who reintroduced meditation into common people. Otherwise, it was purely monks and nuns. Now, in Tibetan, in our society in Ladakh, which is a Tibetan-dominated Buddhism, meditation is just for monks and nuns, not for people like us. Now, when I started meditation programs, the whole village looks at me something like a strange person, crazy person. What is he doing? Meditation is not for you. Where is your cave? This is what they ask. Where is your cave? You don't have a cave. You don't have shaven head. You are not wearing robe. How can you meditate? This is the thing that has happened over the centuries. And of course, when Buddha dies or any great teacher dies, schools are born. And schools are born with their own definition, with their own identity. My school should be like this. My school should look like this. This is what happened. And that is why the Shila, the morality, the foundation that the Buddha gave, he gave for normal people like us at least 5 to be followed in our life as a very strong foundation. Remember this. I'm sure many of you know it. This first block stone for your house, I call it the very strong block foundation stone. If you don't have that, your house may have other stones, but if this cornerstone is not there, any time it might collapse on the other side. The first one, Buddha says, is not to harm or hurt any living beings whatsoever, no matter what. Intentionally to hurt or harm any living beings, to destroy any living beings, if you do that, then your foundation is very weak. If you really want to progress on the path to meditation, to develop, to build this house of meditation, to build this house of peace, you can give any name, peace of harmony, peace of joy, if you want to build it, unless you practice, develop this mind of not to harm or hurt any living beings, I'm very sorry, your house is very weak. But this practice also, in the tradition of Buddhist countries, it sounds very intellectual for many traditional practicing Buddhists. Once Dalai Lama was teaching, and my brother was sitting next to me, my half-brother, who is a very high official in the government, sitting next to me. He has so much faith in Dalai Lama. It's so much faith. And you know, Tibetan and Ladakhis, they are like so faithful that if they have to give their life, they will say, I'll give my life for Dalai Lama. Such is the faith, strong faith. And Dalai Lama was talking about how not to differentiate caste systems, you know, you should not look down upon others and like this. But now look, my brother, sitting next to me, he looks at Dalai Lama, folded hand, and he says to the Dalai Lama, Dalai Lama, you say anything, you tell us anything, except this one. Don't talk about these things, this we have to follow, but otherwise you tell anything else. This is the blind belief, this is the blind faith that we have. And likewise are the precepts also. When we say not to harm or hurt with this intention to destroy somebody's life, you can't kill even a mosquito without hate. You can't do this. today I don't know how many of you experienced this flies coming to you. There were almost the whole afternoon, there were two flies coming into my mouth. They wanted to sneak into my mouth. And they were really digging. They were really digging my lips to get into it. And I thought, my goodness, these flies, you're so lucky that you came when I'm sitting in meditation. If you came before that, I would have smashed you. The head was there. Immediately head started coming. Then I realized that I'm sitting in meditation. I said to myself, smile. You are in meditation. Just observe. These are beings. They're doing their duty. They like your saliva. Let them drink. They were really poking everywhere. It was so sensitive. And you know, our lips are very sensitive when a fly sits here. It was so difficult to practice. Because the reaction is there. Anger is there to kill it. Because all our life we've been doing that. One little ant comes here, supposing on your dining table, you just throw it out or you just like press it like this. This is what we do. In Thailand, my mother-in-law, she comes with a tennis racket-like thing. You know, tennis racket, to play tennis. But this tennis racket is a bit different. It has a button somewhere. And she does like this in the room, and suck, 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 suck. And then I didn't realize what she's doing. And suddenly I realized this tennis racket is not a tennis racket. It is a mosquito-killing racket. And you press this button, you kill these mosquitoes. Suddenly my wife whispers to mother-in-law and says, hey, look, Vivek does not kill. What are you doing? Oh, sorry, sorry, sorry. I'm very sorry. And she keeps this racket aside and says, oh, okay, I'm very sorry. I didn't know that. Vivek does not kill. And now mosquito has to come. It has to come. Came. And mother-in-law takes fun. She's a very funny lady. As soon as the mosquito comes, she you know what she does? Oh, mosquitoes, go to Vivek. And she pushes all the mosquitoes to me. They don't kill you. Don't come to me. I will kill you. This is not killing for her. But she does it with so... And I see she's killing flies. She really does it with so much of anger. These flies, you know, we also have invented beautiful things to kill this fly also. This plastic thing looks like a something, I don't know, like a spoon or whatever. Like this. Really, so much of anger is this. This damn flies. And then I told Anne, hey, look, you should not do this. You know what my wife says? She said, oh, Vivek, you haven't seen. If my mother-in-law sees, you know, ants does not usually go one. They have a long line when they go. And she was telling me very proudly, my mother, when she sees ants, she will do like this, press it like this, and kill all of them in line. I was a bit shocked. But that's how they do. And as soon as we say, hey, you're breaking Sheila, she says, no, 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 I'm not breaking Sheila. I didn't kill any person. For them, the precept is to kill some person, to stab somebody with a knife. That is killing. But we forget, hate starts from this little and gets piled up. Each hate that you develop makes an impression on the mind. And that is why Buddha says, don't do this. Because if you keep on making impression on the mind, how can you meditate? So meditation is not complete. So if you want to make a strong foundation, Buddha says, practice this. Now which religion, I think most religion teaches the same thing, don't hurt or harm any living beings. Most religions speak the same thing. There's no religion as to say, this is Buddhist precept, I don't want to practice. Nothing doing. It is just not to harm or hurt. We don't want to be hurt. I don't want to be killed by any one of you. I don't want my nose to be punched by any one of you. So why should I punch your nose? This is why Buddha says, try to practice this. And if you practice this, then your foundation is strong. Otherwise, there are people who meditate for years and years and years, 20 years, 30 years, and then they say, you know, nothing is happening to me. I met many people who have meditated for 20 years, come to me and say, I've meditated for 20 years. And, you know, the language they use to describe the courses, I just have to laugh deep inside. They say, you know, I've done that sort of stuff, you know, like 10 days or like 1 week stuff, a lot, you know, stuff. They call it the stuff. 10-day course or these courses are stuffs. I've done these sort of stuffs, you know, about 10 times, 20 times. Nothing is happening. Probably you have not checked your foundation. The foundation is weak no matter how many years you spend. You spend your life, yet You can't meditate. Then the second one Buddha says is, not to take anything that does not belong to you. Our society today is in a big chaos because big robberies, big stealing, in a very gross English language it is called stealing. But in your country, and most of you that I see here seems to be quite well to do, you don't need to take anything that does not belong to you. Not that once we finish this, you say, oh, this is a beautiful knife in the kitchen, maybe I can have it. And you sneak a knife or a spoon. I don't think you need to do this because all of you have enough of spoons and everything at home. But in India, this applies very much, this precept. We have a big problem. And of course, in Jerusalem, good example, the lady that I was staying with, her granddaughter came in her car. She was shifting her stuff from somewhere to Jerusalem. And she parked the car, and just 5 minutes, she took something, kept the car open, not the car locked, and she took something, and she had all her collection of DVDs, about 80 of them, music and whatever beautiful stuff, in the car. And she quickly went up and came down to bring the rest of the stuff. In just 5 minutes, all her things were gone in the car. 5 minutes. And now when you take somebody's, look at how she felt. She felt so sad that how, you know, wonderful things were stolen. And that is what Buddha says, not to take anything that does not belong to you. On the other hand, whatever you have, share with others. You don't lose anything by sharing. And in Buddhist countries, this is taught very nicely so that people will share. If you share, you get. So Buddhist people, they, even Hindus, they offer so much with this belief that I will get so much. Not with this intention to get, just pure sharing has to be done, just like this. So this is the second foundation. Third one is not to indulge in any unlawful sexual relationship or sexual intercourse. Now this is a big issue whenever I have to talk about this sexual thing. Somebody told me when I was giving a workshop in Ladakh, of course, people from Europe or from your country, somebody told me, Vivek, I said, look, this foundation means that you don't have any sexual relationship beyond your marriage or beyond your relationship. If you're married, if you're husband and wife, fine. If you're not married, but if you're living together, fine. Be loyal to each other. This is what I was saying. And somebody said, Vivek, but you know, I'm traveling, and what if we just, you know, just decide and accept, you know, just to have sex? What's wrong? If both of us agree and we just want to have it, just, you know, we make no commitments, what's wrong? It seems that you don't make any commitments, but do you know how much of commitment you make when you have sexual intercourse? There is so much of emotion involved, first of all. Secondly, so much of lust involved. And this lust, the more you indulge, the more it grows. And that is why you keep on making impressions after impression. That's why the Buddha said, when you are married, then be loyal to each other. Why? Because having one wife or having one partner itself is a big problem. And supposing if you have 10 relationships, 10 big problems. And if you are married, if you are living together, you know how big problem is your partner. That is why Buddha says, better not. Just stick to your partner, be loyal to it. Buddha never denied sexual relationship. But he gave always the right place. Because then you don't become wild. Otherwise, the animal instinct starts coming up and you want to sleep and jump on everybody. You look at this person, you want to have sex. With you look at this person, you want to have sex. If you are loyal to your partner, you say, oh, I have a responsibility. Oh, no. The rest are my brothers and sisters. That's my practice, what I do. I try to do. Whenever any sexual thoughts comes to my mind, I tell myself, hey, look, Vivek, you have such a wonderful family, and you have such a wonderful commitment. And after all, this is just a lust. Oh, you're my brothers and sisters. This is how I look at people. And that reduces this lustful mind. Otherwise, there is endless lust. That's why the Buddha kept it as very important foundation. And we all know that how much of problem comes through sexual relationships, which is not lawful. And the fourth one is not to speak anything which is not the truth. In our life, try to speak the truth. This is what the Buddha says. Not to speak anything which is not the truth. But we keep on telling, and Buddha also emphasizing, not to exaggerate. Even to exaggerate something is not the truth. And in India we say, if somebody says something, we say, hey, don't add masala in it. That means don't add spices in your speech. That means what? If you want to say something to somebody, you put all these spices, and Indians are so used to spices, to add spices in your speech also, so that when you hear it sounds so tasty, wow. So Buddha says, even no adding masalas. You try to stick to the truth, and then your foundation is very strong. And then the last one, the Buddha says, not to take or depend on any intoxicating things that confuses the mind, like drugs or drinking or all kinds of things. And this also creates a very deep impact on the human mind. Please remember. People keep on arguing. People who drink, they have every excuse to say, no, this is not true. What's wrong in drinking one bottle of beer? And my friends keep saying, don't you drink apple juice? I say, yes, I drink apple juice. Then they say, this is wheat juice. What's wrong in it? Wheat juice, same thing. Why you don't drink? But anything that contains alcohol makes the mind more confused or more unconscious. And we are trying to build a house of consciousness, being aware, and you drink all this and you become more unconscious. Everything becomes so confused. That's why Buddha says, the best thing is just don't take it. I've taken a vow all my life not to take it. Finish. I've never taken it so far. I've never tasted what a wine is, what a whiskey is, whatever it is. I don't even know the names of it. But I've had also experiences where people offered me to say, just take one sip. And this, everything starts from one sip, and it goes to one sip, and it goes to one glass, then it goes to one bottle, then it goes to second bottle, and bottles after bottles, bottles after bottles. I heard now in England, they have a drinking systems where they call it the, you can drink as much as you can, within a certain limit of money you pay, and then endless drinking. And these young people, they go and drink and drink and drink. In Korea, I saw myself, mistakenly, I ended up in a bar at 2 o'clock in the morning. Some of my friends wanted to drink. They said, well, let's go and eat something. They took me to a bar. I didn't know that. All right, I have no problem going to a bar. I spent time in a bar. And I was so shocked. These young boys and girls were sitting together. And suddenly there was a boy and girl. The boy started just sitting there very normally, started throwing right there. He was throwing very normally, as if there's nothing. He was throwing. And after throwing, started drinking again. After like 10 minutes, he was throwing again. The waiter comes, cleans. The waiter is coming, clean. Then I saw another partner, again the same thing, throwing, drinking, throwing, drinking. Madness, at 2 o'clock in the morning. This creates a very deep impact on the mind, and the impression that it creates on human mind is very difficult. We have already so packed in our mind, as I told you, there's no space in the human mind. And if you keep on adding more and more impression, then when will you ever empty your mind of all these impurities? That is why Buddha says, Shila, these five minimum for normal people like us, minimum, try to practice. Try, not practice. This is not a testament, not a law. Try to practice. And I keep telling friends, in the five, if you have all the excuses under the sky to say, well, I can't, I can practice the first one, but I can't practice the rest of the four. Good. At least practice one. If you have all the excuses to say, I can't practice the first two, the rest I can practice, then go ahead. Otherwise, life has no meaning. Life has no principles. If you don't have a principle, then our life has no meaning. If you have a meaning, if you have a purpose in life to develop this foundation, then you have something to practice. Otherwise, what is there to practice? I've seen people change their whole life by practicing these principles. Because these principles leads you to the second middle path. Second path of the middle path, that is called samadhi, concentration of the mind. What is concentration of the mind? Every now and then we are so frustrated, we all sorts of things coming up in the mind all our life, we keep on letting the mind do whatever it wants to do. And the mind always goes in two places. There is no other place for the mind to go, only two places. And that is, either the mind starts reliving of all that is gone forever, starts reliving, and try to look at it as something which is very real. But it is gone forever. Give you an example. This evening talk, once it is gone for your life. This will never ever come back in your life. Imagine. It's going. It can't come back. And yet, I hope not that some of you, but somebody, some of you might come back, may come back and sit here and say, hey, yesterday, please bring back that yesterday. Do everything. I will do everything, but please bring back yesterday evening talk. You cannot bring back. Imagine, 100 years from now, none of us will be sitting on this roof. None of us. In 100 years, maybe even less than 100 years, but in 100 years, none of us will be here. All gone. And we start reliving the past which is gone forever, keep on thinking, and suddenly get so angry, suddenly get so frightful, suddenly get so jealous, which is gone forever. One incident. Second incident, either the mind is in the past, or it starts reliving, trying to create a future, and again it is such an illusionary future, and yet the mind goes into that path so well that it starts reliving as if this is real for me. This will happen to me, this must happen to me, this happened to me. When I first fell in love with a Swiss lady, of course, I was so amazed. The dreams that I had in my mind, at that time I was young, I didn't know all these sort of, theoretically I know from Buddhist scriptures, this is this, should not have desires, this. But when I fell in love, my goodness, all of you know that experience. I was in the seventh heaven, and I was seeing from that moment of falling in love, to like 10 years from now, I saw where I'm going to stay in Switzerland. I saw my house in Switzerland. I saw my children in Switzerland, and I saw we were like singing and dancing like in a Bollywood movie. I was so fixed in my mind, you can't believe it. And many a times, most of us have that. Really, it was so set in my mind. And one day, of course, you know, when you fall in love, of course, you wait for your partner. Let's say you have an appointment, date with your partner. 5 o'clock we'll meet. You are 4 o'clock there, or even 3 o'clock there, waiting. She's coming, or he's coming, doesn't matter. And one day she was late by half an hour. Do you know, in that half an hour, I got such a shock. I saw the whole dream shattered, you know. I thought something must have happened to her. Something happened to her, and I saw the whole thing was shattered. And I thought, my goodness, that was the first time in my life I've ever got such a shock at a deep level of my mind. Otherwise, I was so making it real, and I was so attached, within the short time, I was so attached to my future. And when it shattered, in reality, when it shattered, mind you, I was... from seventh heaven, I fell to the seventh hell. So miserable. Why? Because the mind was always in the future. And the future is not real, but we keep on living. And what do we do? We let loose the mind. Go to the dreaming, imagination, these. Or you start saying, oh, this is not interesting today. Go to the past. Madness. Now Buddha says samadhi. That means concentration of the mind to be in this very moment, which is the truth of the moment. The truth of the moment is now. This moment is the truth. As soon as it is gone, it is not the truth. You think one more one step ahead, it is not the truth. This is the truth. And why the Buddha took the breathing? Because the breath that you're taking every moment, now you take this breath, that is the truth. That is the breath of life. You're taking this breath, this is the truth for this moment. And this truth is the law of nature. Nobody, you can't create the breath. You say, now, alright, now I'm taking rest. Hey breath, you take rest also, you must be tired. All of your life you've been breathing, now you take rest. You can't say this. This is the law of nature. The day you stop breathing, you're gone. That is why Buddha chose this breath, because this breath, whether you sit here, whether you're sleeping, or you're walking the streets, or you're waiting for the bus, or you're anywhere else, breath is all the time with you. You go to Ladakh, the same breath is there. Of course, different air is there. But breath is there. So the Buddha chose this breath as an object to be observed, to bring the mind focused to this point. Of course, Buddha gave 40 subjects of meditation mentioned in the Buddhist scriptures. If any one of you are interested, you can go through. We have no time, otherwise I would have described all the 40 subjects. Anyway, the breathing is the most commonly practiced now, which is widely accepted, because many teachers feel that breath, you can take it, it is always with you. So wherever you are, you can just be on the breath. When you have nothing to do, just breath. And you're meditating. So slowly and slowly, if your foundation is strong, then the mind, the foundation is strong, then the mind is much more calmer. Then your mind, to be focused in this one point of your breath, becomes much more easier. Because your mind is not so occupied with killing somebody or stealing or like sexual. You're not occupied with all this. So the mind is much more easier to be focused. So you can say, oh, one breath at a time. I'm sure during this whole day, I don't know how many breaths you could observe. And people get so frustrated. I said for 1 hour, not even one breath. What is this? This meditation is not for me. Maybe for this person, maybe for this person. Not for me at least. I couldn't even look one breath. Doesn't matter. I keep telling people, if you sit for 1 hour, even if you can observe even one in-breath or maybe out-breath, even one, good enough. That's the first step. You can't jump to this roof. You have to take the steps one by one. And unless you take the first step, you can't go to the second step. So even one breath, if you observe, that's a very good sign of samadhi. Samadhi. So little by little, you start developing samadhi, samadhi, samadhi. And in your daily life also, every moment, whenever you have a free time, don't just go and, of course, there has to be time when you read something or you listen to music. Do that. Doesn't matter. But one thing at a time. Not call yourself multitasking. You want to listen to music, eat your sandwich and also this coffee and, you know, all kinds of things. TV news is on, this news is on. All multitasking doesn't work. First of all, it's an illusion that a person can be multitasking. Mind can only do one thing at a time. It can't do two things at a time. But mind, Buddha says, with a snap of fingers, trillions of thoughts arise in the mind. One blink on the eye, trillions of thoughts arise in the mind. So you can imagine how quickly the mind switches. And we're thinking, oh, I'm very proud, I can do multitasking. No, the mind is so restless. We are adding to your restlessness by being multitasking. Do one thing at a time if you want to develop your samadhi, even in your daily life. It helps. Samadhi leads to panya. Now, today we were focusing more on samadhi because it's a very short time. At least you have some peace of mind, some calmness comes if you have practiced it. Even if you have tried, good, it comes. And how wonderful it is to be in a group like this, complete silent. I kept on saying we are in a group where we are all individuals. And we are individuals. When you were born, you came alone. When you go alone. Not that you say, now let's go together. You hold your hands and say, you'll go together, you can't do this. We are going together, we came alone, we'll go alone. So it was a wonderful group that each one of us, we were trying our best. And I don't feel anything more wonderful than group of people sitting together in silent, trying to observe one's own inner self, trying to develop this mind. And this is what it adds. That is why Buddha, even during the time of the Buddha, monks used to go to the forest to meditate all alone. But there were times when they had to come together to meditate together. Not that you spend all your life in the forest and you disappear in the forest. No, once in a while we come together. Even in our life also, of course, you meditate at home, but it is highly recommended once in a month. I am so happy that here in Israel there are so many wonderful groups, small groups. I visited in Jerusalem, there was a wonderful group also. Beautiful house, apartments like this. You open your house. This is what we have done also. We call it Dhamma house. Open your house for others. Once in a month, once in a week, you come together, group like this, it helps. Otherwise, many a times what happens, if you are alone meditating, you get frustrated, maybe it doesn't work, and then many a times people say, no, I give up. But if a group, you have a Dhamma friends like this, then what happens? It helps, it helps. By the way, Venerable Ananda asked Buddha, he says, well, look, Buddha, if you have the right spiritual friend, I think half of your spiritual journey is completed. Buddha says, oh no, not half. If you have the right spiritual friend, journey is completed. Journey is completed. And I'm sure most of you have experienced this. When you have the right spiritual Dhamma friend, whenever you have anything, he doesn't say, oh yeah, you must go and hit him. Will never say this. Say, hey, look, you know, you have reacted. So look, let's analyze what's happened. Sit down, discuss. This is called Dhamma friend. And that is why Buddha says, Buddha gives so much of importance to Dhamma friends, to the Sangha that you have formed here, saying that it is, journey is completed. Once you have the right friend, journey is completed. Look. So if you want, you be integrated like this and once in a while sit in a group to inspire each other to, you know, if somebody has gone low, the other's energy helps you to come up. That is how you can practice, keep practicing samadhi, samadhi, samadhi. Then comes panya, wisdom, wisdom. Buddha, this was the discovery of the Buddha of wisdom. This samadhi was there before Buddha. Shila was there before Buddha. But the Shila was there before Buddha. But many teachers said, well, you can practice if you want. If you don't want, you don't practice. That was the optional. Buddha says, no. You have to practice if you want to move to samadhi. And samadhi was there during the time of Buddha, before Buddha also, even today also we have the samadhi. But Buddha's samadhi is right samadhi. And panya is the Buddha's discovery. That is what differentiates Buddha and what you call today Hindu religion. What was the ancient time? Of course now it's called Hinduism. The difference is Buddha discovered and he went out of the structure of the, if you want to call it Hinduism, and discovered vipassana. That was Buddha's contribution to the world. Vipassana is made of two words. Passana means to see. And vi plus passana. Passana means to see, vi means wisdom. To see with wisdom, to see with understanding, to see things as they really are, to see the truth. Not as you would like it to be. And that is called vipassana. Now, we have been practiced today, but I kept on telling you, don't react or don't resist anything. Sounds were coming. There were a lot of sounds around, flies around. Good exercise, thanks to the flies, gave us a lot of exercise to do. Vipassana is, you don't resist anything. You start, the whole philosophy around vipassana is, just observe and not react. The whole message of vipassana is all our life we've been reacting, reacting, reacting. Something, somebody says something, you react. You hear somebody saying something about you, you react. You say something to somebody, you react. All the time, constant reaction, reaction, reaction. Again, react with what? Hate, anger, jealousy, lust. Constantly reacting. Now this has become the habit of our mind. Right? We have been habituated. Like, you know, cigarette smoking, people have to keep on smoking, you say, oh, this is my bad habit. But the most strongest habit of every one of us is the reacting mind, the habit of the mind to react. Now, Buddha says, stop reacting. Instead of reacting, you start understanding that this is changing constantly, which is changing, why should you react with craving? You keep on craving, craving, it changes suddenly. So Buddha says, don't crave. He also didn't deny that don't have everything. No, there should not be no desires. You don't have this, you don't have this. No, you have it, but don't develop attachment around it. Give you one example. I was in Delhi buying my laptop. went to the showroom, you know, when all these laptops in line, you go and like, you know, it's not your laptop, so you go like this, test this mouse, you know, screen, touch like this and like this, move like this. That's not your laptop. Do you know, as soon as I chose the laptop that I wanted, and when I paid the bill, he brought the laptop. Now my laptop. It was so funny, I really enjoyed this observation of how the mind reacts and how subtle this attachment becomes. As soon as he brought my laptop, first of all, he brought it and put it down like this. Big shock. I told him, slowly. As soon as the laptop becomes yours, you immediately say, slowly. I said, slowly, you know, my laptop. And then he was opening the laptop. Again, you know, like a salesperson, once it is sold, they don't care much. In India, even more careless. They are like tearing the stickers here, stickers this, opening the box. My laptop. What if something damaged when you open, might scratch my laptop. Slow. Such a miserable it was when you open the laptop, first of all. Look at the attachment that was at a deeper level, which you don't realize. Then he tested my laptop, put in the plug and on. And you know that mouse pad, he was doing like this and like this, you know. He was testing, which was good. But I felt, mouse pad, it is soft. Do it slowly. But he was doing like this. So much afraid, my laptop. All right, that was one incident. So I came, packed, everything was good. As soon as I got out of the showroom with my laptop, suddenly there was fear. What if somebody comes and just snatches my laptop? That fear became so strong in me that I started holding the laptop with two hands. And Delhi markets, you know, it is so crowded and everybody more or less looks like a thief. Yes, they look like more like not well dressed, and then they look at you, stare at you like this, and you feel like he's eyeing at your laptop. So I told the salesman, hey, look, can you drop me until the rickshaw, you know, can you bring me up to the rickshaw to make sure that nobody snatches your laptop? Look at the madness. Unconsciously it becomes. Why? Because it has become the habit of the mind. But later on, when I realized, when I got home, my friend said, can I see a laptop? I said, sure. He had a laptop before, so he knew how to use laptop. And I've never used a laptop before. I mean, never owned a laptop before. So I didn't know whether you could open it, how. He just went, took my laptop and just opened it like this, fully, you know, like. And I'm like, oh no. I couldn't tell him that you're breaking my laptop. But I said, you're breaking my laptop. Because I don't know anything about laptop. I always said, like, it should be opened very slowly, you know, like this. And closed very slowly. He went like this and like this, checking like this. Overturned the laptop. I was more afraid. I thought, now everything is falling. Such is the habit of our attachment. We identify so much with it that we buy not only the laptop, but a whole package of things with us. Fears, worries, tension and all kinds of things. Now, when I went back to Ladakh, then I started thinking, what happened, all this incident. Then I laughed at myself, oh no, that was not right. Now I have this laptop, but now I, of course, superficially, this is my laptop, but I don't own it. And now I'm very happy. In our house, we don't lock doors. We don't even close doors. Normally, we go out, just, you know, bolt it, and that's it. My sister told me, you must close your door when you go out. I said, why? Your laptop, somebody might take it. And I laughed. At that time, I laughed. I said to myself, hey, look, from my side, this laptop is a donation. If somebody steals my laptop at this point, from my side, it's a donation. So I don't worry. I don't care if somebody takes my laptop. Not that somebody, of course, I might have it. You don't say, thank you, it's a donation, I want it. But I started developing this in my mind with many things. I've started developing, and I tell you, it works so well. Otherwise, what happens? If my friend's laptop falls from the table and breaks it, I will say, hey, you stupid, you don't know how to manage your laptop. You should have been more careful. I don't feel any bad about it. Now, my laptop falls. I don't lecture myself, you've been careful. You start worrying about it. This is the attachment. So, In Vipassana, what do? You own things, you buy things, you have the best car. Not that you shouldn't have the best car. If you can afford it, you have the best car. But when you buy the car, don't buy all this package altogether. And when you have it, of course you take all the precautions that needed to be to protect your car. You can do your best. But not that you lose all your sleep thinking, oh, somebody might rob my car. Not like this. That is where you don't identify yourself, and yet you own things. This is what the Buddha says, Vipassana. That is what you practice. Now when you sit down, what do you practice? There is feelings there. Sometimes good feelings, sometimes not good feelings. Sometimes, you know, it seems to have no feelings. It is like neutral. There's no predominant feelings. And yet you just remain balanced. Don't lose the balance of your mind, either for craving, wanting to have it, or at the same time not wanting to push it away. Sometimes we always want things to us and want to pull it us. Sometimes we don't want it. Again, we're doing the same habit. This habit, this is the habit of the mind. Now we're working with the feelings of the body. Why? Because Buddha was the one who discovered. When you have the senses, we are born with the six senses. As soon as we are born, there is contact with the senses. That is why when we first come into the world, do you smile? Yes? Also, you are the first baby who smiled. Usually when the baby comes out, you really cry. I was looking at one of the books at our home, and there is in Kamel's place, there's a thin book, Where Did I Come From or something. It's children's book about saying where I came from. And I was so surprised. At the end, the baby comes out, the description is, the last time when I came out, the last stage of my coming out into the world was so miserable. So miserable, so difficult. So that thing is there. Suffering, when we come with the first suffering. So the conditioning of the mind starts from birth itself. So the habit is there, wanting, not wanting. Now Buddha discovered when you have this contact, feeling arises. Before, people didn't know. People always thought, when I look at this person gives me the hate. This person gives me hate. Or when you see something, you want it, so you think that this person creates. No. Actually, Buddha says when there is a contact, there is a feeling at the bodily level. Then only the craving is there for the feelings. And that is why Vipassana, we work with the feelings, because that feeling is the determining factor between you and the object that comes into contact with the senses. And when you work with this gap, then you see the reality. Hey, look, I am reacting to the feelings, not to this object. Before we conclude, we give you one last story. And I'm telling you this story because I feel Israelis are very romantic people. So end with romantic story. During the time of Buddha, there was one little nun, beautiful nun, like any one of you here, beautiful young lady. And suddenly, she became a nun. She became a nun, and she was enlightened. She attained a very high stages. And she was walking very mindfully, like we did, like a tortoise today. Very mindfully, slowly walking. For us, only during retreats, we walk slowly, mindfully, and we sit down mindfully, we eat mindfully. Mostly during the retreats, we do that. But for monks and nuns, it is their whole life. That is their life itself. So this nun became rich to a very high level, and she was meditating and going to the forest where she had a little hut. Now there was a prince who was madly in love with this this lady, madly. And he just wanted to go and tell this nun that, look, I love you. And he always used to follow this nun, you know, every day. And nun never responded. She was all into herself, just meditating, never looked back or never nothing. One day the prince got so frustrated, he cut down one tree and blocked the road. And of course the nun had to stop for a while and think how to get over this. And there he comes with his arms open. He says, hey, look, I love you so much. What madness are you doing? Look, you're so beautiful. Why you don't marry me? I love you so much. I give you the best things in the world. Come with me. And the nun was, of course, she had attained to this meditation stage. She looked at this prince and said, well, she immediately knew, of course, as a meditator, you know what do you like in this person? And the nun says, all right, tell me, what is it that you feel so pleasing? What is it that you are in so much love with me? after all, what is there in me that you love so much, that you're so mad about me? And he started saying, oh, your eyes are like pearls. I love your eyes. Incredible eyes. When I see your eyes, I just fall in love. This is the description the prince gave. And then she looked at the prince and said, oh, so you love my eyes? He says, yes, I love your eyes. And she said, all right, then you have my eyeballs. She took off her eyeballs and gave it to him. Of course, we can't do this. She was highly attained, so she could do it. No attachment to this one. But what I'm trying to say is, we always forget that there is something in between me, something between you, the object, sense, and the object is there at this. In between there is this something what we call the feelings at the bodily level. And that is why we work at the bodily level, because this is more subtle than looking at this person. You don't look at this person and say, now I practice vipassana on you. You can't say this. Then you can never practice vipassana. Vipassana you practice at your own level, at the physical level, what you experience at that moment, that is how you work. And you start to understand three things in vipassana. You start to understand that everything is constantly changing. Constant changing, changing, changing is there. Once you understand, we say, if you understand this change during this process of vipassana, even in one moment you can be enlightened. You understand this change moment to moment, moment to moment. One moment you understand, moment to moment you try to understand that constantly there is nothing which is permanent. Everything is changing constantly. And which is changing constantly, where is the need to attach to this one? How can you say, this is me, I am? Then this is just a changing phenomenon. But when you experience this at a very deep level, at the experiential level, then only wisdom, panya arises. Otherwise, mere intellectual, it's very easy to say, I know, I'm going to die, I know this. Immediately people say, I know. Please remember, the moment you say, I know, you don't know it. That is the first sign of ignorance. When you say, I know, you don't know it. Say, I don't know, that is the first step to understanding I know. Intellectually, we seem to understand. But go deep into meditation, even experienced meditators will suddenly experience after many years, this I didn't experience. This is what happens. This is what happens. That's why I never call myself teacher, and I never want to be a teacher. Why? Because for me, it's a whole life learning. I've come here to Israel. You don't know how much I've learned. I don't know how much you have learned from me, but I've learned so much from you. This much is for sure. And I'm taking so much from Israel back home. So this is how we try to understand, and this is the path of the Buddha. Keep trying to practice. Trying to practice if you want to see some meaning, some purpose in your life. Otherwise, life has no meaning whatsoever. We're just living. We are always in the future or in the past. We are not living at all. Buddha says, if you are not aware, you are like dead. Or you are in a deep sleep. You are not awake. Wake up. Buddha says, wake up. And wake up is to be in this very moment, which is the truth. Right? So before we have question answers, shall we all sit down for a few minutes? So we'll have our question and answer sessions. If any one of you have any questions, you may ask. Any questions pertaining to what we discussed just now, or anything? Any questions concerning meditation? Yes, everybody has understood everything, or probably understood nothing.
A question about the ego.
Yeah.
If the ego is taking over my life, and influence my decision and my many my way, so in me to bring me to or send me to do meditation and kill the ego.
Well, interesting question. I was monk for 3 years. And I was such an egoistic person. And I never realized that I was so egoistic person. I was very adamant, very like, you know, all are wrong, I'm only right. And this was fed in me from primary school to middle school to college to my monk's life and even my profession. I mean, the jobs that I did was always ego feeding. And one day, one of my very junior boy who is my student, he came to me and said, Vivek, I was to, you know, meet the college boys and give a lecture. It was years ago. And he said to me, Vivek, before you give the lecture, I want to say something to you. Do you know what he told me? He said, Vivek, you're such an egoistic person. And for the first time in my life, I realized, and I'm a meditator. I'm a meditator, and this person says, to tell you the truth, you are a very egoistic person. He told me. And I was so shocked. But I'm a meditator, so I started saying, oh, you got to observe now. It wasn't so pleasing and interesting for you. And the best way I could overcome that was, I went to this boy and said to him, thank you so much. You make me realize how egoistic I was. And from that day on, I told myself, you start breaking your ego. And I started becoming, consciously, I started becoming more humble in front of others. Very humble in front of others. Even if I knew, I tried not to push myself in a discussion, let's say, you know, when we meet friends, I tried not to push, though I knew the answer, I tried not to push because I didn't want to feed this ego. And that was the time when I first understood how important meditation was for me to kill this ego. And I had to put so much of effort to come to this meditation, to kill this. And I was a slave, I tell you, for this ego. And today I feel so happy. After like a year later, somebody comes to me and says, hey Vivek, he's saying this to you. Do you know my reaction? It was very funny, spontaneous. I smiled and said, don't worry about it. He's the Buddha for me. I did like this and I said, he's a Buddha for me. I was full of smiles. And when I met this guy in person, he had no hate for me. Supposing if I would react with my ego saying, how dare you say this, fight would have taken. But then I found how the meditation had worked on me. So what I would suggest is, instead of battling with the ego, as and when you get the opportunity, just keep on reflecting on your own ego, saying, look, this is an illusion. Ego comes from an illusion that I exist. You know, I am very important. This is how it comes. Now in meditation also, there was a joke also. Somebody is meditating and says, I'm meditating. Listen to the sentence. Somebody is meditating and he's saying, I'm meditating. Have you got the sentence?
No.
No? Somebody is meditating and he says, I'm meditating.
Yeah, but this duality, this maybe there isn't duality. Well, there isn't duality. But I feel sometimes there is duality. There's somebody having a conversation with his ego.
That's
I
true.
Feel it. I feel it like some other person.
Yeah.
I sometimes catch myself doing things and I'm laughing myself. I said, who's laughing on who? You see, who is laughing about the ego? Who's the what left?
Anyway, I got you. Let me tell you. Human mind has two levels.
Uh-huh.
One is the conscious level, and one is so-called the subconscious level. And usually, if you are not a meditator, there is no connection between the surface part of the mind, the loud part of the mind, and the subconscious level. There is no connection. And that is why what happens is like, we always act at the surface level of the mind, at the loud part of the mind. But we don't know that loud part of the mind is so much influenced by the subconscious level. But if you start to meditate, you will start to see that the subconscious level and the upper, the loud part of the mind, the surface part of the mind, starts connecting. And that is why I call it the inner voice or whatever it is. Sometimes, let's say you become very angry, and deep inside, another voice says, hey, come on, what's silly, what are you doing, relax. It says like this, but the loud part of the mind doesn't want to listen to that. It says, no, beat him. He said this to you, curse him. You start shouting, but deep inside the voice is saying, shouting, but you can't hear it because it is so low. And this connection you get if you are a meditator. So you could always look at like this, that the inner part and the loud part of the mind. And loud part of the mind is mostly in contact, so it is much more influential than the deeper part of the mind. As a meditator, we go deeper and we start listening and checking the deeper part of the mind, which actually is the root of all the influences that makes on the surface part of the mind. So whenever you have this conflict or whatever, you always see from that angle. Then I think that should be okay for you.
Everybody asked me what I'm finding in meditation. I said, to become one. I want to become one.
I'll tell you. Whenever somebody asks you, you say, I'm meditating to become nothing, not one.
Okay.
To become nothing. You lose yourself in meditation, not build yourself. If you're saying one, again there's ego. There's no one, no two. There's nothing. No, you dissolve, in meditation we're dissolving the so-called self. In other words, what I'm trying to say is, dissolve the ego. That's what we're trying to do. So if anybody asks you, you say, to be nothing.
But if, for example, I feel, you know, that it's a part of me, this want or this craving or this attachment, you know, it's something that I really would want, you know, for myself.
Yeah.
And I don't want to dissolve it.
Then that's your choice. You want to live with all this craving and attachment?
No, but not all of them. Like,
Then you can choose. Life is a choice. You see, it is very difficult. If you can live with this choice, it's good. If you can say, oh, these things I like, these things I don't like. If you can choose, and if you have the power to choose, go ahead. But most of the time, we have no power to choose. We are slaves to the mind. And many a times, what you want never happens. What you don't want happens. You understand? So, you can choose. If you have the power, it's up to you. Life is yours. You're the master. Yes, please. Right. So your question is, you can always, I mean, without attachment, you can pursue whatever you want to do in life. Like you want to become, let's say, a doctor, let's say. You want to become a doctor. Look, as a meditator, there is nothing wrong in pursuing a profession. Nothing wrong. You work hard to make enough money, or you work hard to become this profession, it is fair enough. We have to do that. But the thing is, you have to be very conscious. This is my vision. Whether it happens or not, you can only do one thing, try your best. You understand? So if you're aware of this, I will try my best. If it happens, I'll smile. If it doesn't happen, yet I smile. Then that means you're pursuing it without attachment. Otherwise, I tell you, we fix so fixed in our mind, if it doesn't happen, we like crush ourselves. That's the problem. So as a meditator, you keep on saying, if it happens, happens, if it doesn't happen, I smile. And that's how I came to Israel also. When I came, I was told like, Israel is so complicated, difficult, embassy, this, that. I told myself, look, I will go with a smile to the embassy. If they give me the visa, fine. If they don't give me the visa, also fine, but my smile will always remain. I would have not regretted if they didn't give me the visa, because I was already prepared in my mind. There was no attachment to come, like, you know, I have to get there. I was very open. I thought, it's a troubled country, it's a difficult country, and my smile worked so well. Nobody disturbed me until Israel. Nobody. At the airport, they said they will ask you this paper, they will ask cash, you have cash or not? I had no cash, where can I get cash? They said, you must have certain cash. I thought to myself, everything will be okay. Nothing will happen. If it doesn't happen, doesn't matter, I will smile and come back. I was prepared like this. Nothing happened. Now, if I didn't have that, even a big, small harassment would have created shock in me. You know, that's the attachment. No, if it doesn't happen, then you cling to it. So just let go. You have to try your best to reach there. You have tried your best. If you reach, good. If you don't reach, also good. That's how you take it without attachment. Yes?
Sometimes there is a separation between the practice and life. I see that a lot around. A person comes to the mat or to the pillow and sits and meditates, and then goes to life, and things are being done differently in life. And I guess the question is, how do you take practice into life in that sense? How do you... Maybe the answer is awareness, I don't know, but...
You see, that's one of the messages that I've been talking about. In daily life, all our daily life is either to do with profession, studies, if you're a student, or our domestic things that we do at home, washing, dishes, or you interact with students or friends or meeting friends, having parties, this is our practical daily life, right? You can't say, now I'm a meditator, I can't go out party. You have to go for party, you have to do all kinds of things. But try to do with this awareness, little bit awareness. I'm not saying that whole time you're just aware. That's a long journey. You understand? That has to be there. That is a long journey. But start from little by little. You will fail 100 times. At least even one time you're successful, good. That itself is a big change. Even one time. When I was in the office, you get frustrated so much sometimes. One moment you sit down, just observe your breath, I tell you, the whole body and mind starts relaxing. It is so powerful. But you do any other thing to get rid of it, it adds more. So that's how you can carry the message in your daily life. I mean, if you fail, if you reacted to something, you shouted at somebody, it doesn't matter. You've done it because you were not aware. Now, at least having done that, become aware. That's how you apply it. You come back, let's say you shouted at somebody, you got angry. After that you come back and say, oh, look, I've reacted. Look, now let me observe, at least now. Otherwise people never do it. If I say something to you, say, I will not forget all my life. And you remember all your life. Who suffers? You suffer all your life. I'm not going to suffer. I keep smiling. This is what happens, right? So this is how you can work.
What about, satisfying not yourself, but satisfying other people sometimes, like in a relationship, for instance, when you try to satisfy your partner or something, and you feel that you do, that you don't know if you're authentic to yourself, that if you're true to yourself at the same time, or if you're doing it in order for him or her to be more pleased.
You see, as a meditator, I would only say, be straight. Be straight. I don't know in your relationship, but my relationship, many ladies tell me you are not the romantic man. They tell me. Why? Because when I go with my wife, I don't open the door for her like this, in the car. I don't open the door for her. And when we have to sit on the table, I don't take the chair for her like this. I don't do these things. And I don't give a rose on her birthday. I mean, I don't do these things because There are certain things I feel like doing, I do it. But there are many things which the society does, but I don't have it in me, so I don't do it. But many people expect me to do it, which I don't want to do it, because it's not in me. So you could see what, as a meditator, I would only suggest, do things what you feel right. But be sincere of what you're doing. That's it. Be straight. Not here and there. In India we say, where's your nose? Two ways you can show. Straight here. Or else you can say, oh, my nose is here. This way. And you can also show it. It's two way. So as a meditator, you be straight and say, this is my nose. That's it.
Why here? Not
that means what we call crooked, you know. You're not straight. You want to say something, but then you go here and there and all excuses, 100 excuses, instead of the plain and simple fact is to say, where's the nose? You don't have to go around to say this one. And if you want to express something to your partner, say it straight. You don't have to go around like this. But if she's the nature of that one, then of course you do it, because you might lose her then. Then you will tell me that you taught me like this, now I lost her. Alright, so time's running. Any more questions? Yes?
About the commitment not to do it. I don't kill the meat myself, I don't do it with hate, with anger, but I do eat meat. I agree that the people that cover the mouth not to harm the germs, it's crazy. But if we drive a car, if you came here by airplane, you affect the environment, and birds die. How do you know? How can we know how far to go? How to make the decision?
Okay. By the way, our airplane did not kill any bird. Just joking. If we crash with a bird, then we are down. You see, we'll talk about vegetarian. First of all, the best thing is be vegetarian if you have the choice. Because indirectly, you're contributing to killing. You're helping somebody kill, but if you buy meat. Plain and simple fact, you can't hide this. I will not justify to say that is right. I am not a vegetarian, strict vegetarian, but I do not support this also. So if you have the choice to be vegetarian, that's the best thing. And moreover, you know what affects, as a meditator, if you eat meat, what happens? Also listen, whenever you eat an animal, that animal also develops so much of hate, craving is there. And when you eat that meat is like having all these energies of hate and whatever this animalistic nature in it. And you get into that, that energy comes to your body. And it also affects your system.
Especially how they are raised.
Raised and how they're killed. They're not brought very sweetly to the slaughterhouse and saying, hey, I'll give you this and this. No. They're like dragged and I don't know how, but put in machines and all horrible things are going on. At that time, they develop so much of like hate, fear, anger. And all these goes into this, you know, this system, and then you get it. That's why two explanations. One, of course, we contribute. Secondly, it is not healthy. It disturbs your, adds to your anger, whatever it is. The animal, we have three nature, no? Animal, human, and divine nature. So if you eat animal, your animal instinct is added more fuel on it. Choice is yours. Don't go to that extreme, as I told you. Don't go to that extreme, like, let's say, when you take the aeroplane, my intention is not to harm the environment. My intention is to come here, just use as a means of transport. But in the process, if something dies, my intention is not. And I'm not contributing to killing by taking this one. But in meat eating, of course, there is certainly this act. But if you have choice, don't eat. But if you have no choice, and if you like eating, even if you eat, doesn't matter. But you are not directly killing it. At least this chunk is not there. But indirectly, we are contributing. So choice is yours. You have to decide for yourself. I've decided I will not be a strict vegetarian because in Ladakh, sometimes whenever I go to somebody's house, they prepare meat for me especially. And let's say I just go to somebody's house, suddenly they've prepared only meat. And suddenly I say, oh, I don't eat meat. And then the whole family gets so busy preparing some vegetable for me. I don't want to disturb them. I would rather break my, compromise a little bit with this one. But I can't disturb the whole family. And you know, in Ladakh, it's not like here. In Ladakh, when I go to somebody's house or somebody comes to our house, they're like, guests are like, king for us. I mean, you have to give everything, the best for him, and the best thing is meat. Sometimes, without informing where I go, somebody has not prepared vegetables, they will say, oh no, you should have told us before, we would have prepared meat for you. So whenever there is no meat, whenever they prepare all meat, I don't want to say, I don't eat meat, and you have to prepare something. So that's why I'm not pure vegetarian. So I've chosen this, again, within that I've found my middle way, so not an extreme. Right? So try to find your middle way in whatever. Buddha's teachings, middle way, does not mean this middle path. In everywhere you have to find your middle way in order to exist. Right? Alright, so we will sit down and practice metta meditation for a few moments and then we will stop. Feel yourself very fortunate that you have spent the whole day meditating, trying to contemplate, trying to understand, trying to purify the mind. Feel yourself very fortunate that you tried your level best. Feel yourself very fortunate that you have a healthy body and a healthy mind, that you can sit down and meditate. Feel yourself very fortunate that you have this wonderful place to come and meditate. And feel yourself very fortunate that you are surrounded by wonderful Dharma friends. And feel yourself very happy. See yourself smiling. Just see yourself smiling as if you are looking through a mirror and you see yourself smiling, happy. And then make a wishes, may I always remain happy. May I be free from all difficulties. May I be free from all confusions and may I keep on developing my mind. And may I enjoy real peace. Enjoy real happiness. Real peace. Real happiness. As your Dharma friend who has been trying to guide you during the whole day, trying to help you in some little ways, trying to teach you little bits, visualize him also smiling, happily sharing his experiences. May my Dharma friend always remain happy. May he be free from all difficulties and may he keep on sharing for the happiness, for the benefit of many. And may he enjoy real peace, enjoy real happiness, real peace, real happiness. Visualize all the people meditating together here, the whole group, visualize them happily, practicing together. Again, make a wishes, may all of you enjoy real peace. May all of you be free from all difficulties, of all problems. And may you all keep on developing, and keep on understanding this wonderful path. And may all of you enjoy real peace, enjoy real happiness, real peace, real happiness. as your parents, if they're still living, just see them smiling, happily enjoying their time, living together, visualize them together. And if they're separate, then visualize them separately. May my parents always remain happy. May they be free from all difficulties, whether physical or mental. And may they also enjoy real peace, real happiness, real peace, real happiness. As your brothers and sisters, see them smiling, happily enjoying their life. Just see them smiling. May my brothers and sisters always remain happy, free from all difficulties. May they be free from all problems, whether physical or mental. And may they also enjoy real peace, enjoy real happiness, real peace, real happiness. If you have anybody in mind whom you might so-call your enemy, if any person in your life who disturbs the peace in your life or the harmony, just see him also smiling in the same way you visualized yourself. Not a trace of hate should be there in the mind for him. Just as I want to be happy, may you also be happy. You wish him also. May you be free from all difficulties, of all problems, of all confusions. And may you also enjoy real peace, real happiness, real peace, real happiness. Visualize the people who arranged this retreat, who made this happen. See him also smiling, or see them smiling, happily serving, making sure that the retreat goes well with all the love and compassion. All of you enjoy real peace. May all of you enjoy real harmony. May all of you be free from all difficulties, of all problems. And may you also keep developing on this wonderful path, the path of Dhamma, the path to liberation. Visualize all the people in this country, in whatever situation, conditions they may be, just visualize them. And visualize all the people in the world, countless people. Not only the people, there are countless beings in the world, beings living in the ocean, living on the earth, and all those living beings living in the air. Every living being have the equal rights to live on this earth. May all living beings enjoy real peace. May all living beings be free from all difficulties, of all problems and enjoy real peace, real happiness, real peace, real happiness. If during the whole day, whatever you have heard and what you have practiced, and in this process, if I have hurt or harmed any one of your feelings, directly or indirectly, either through my speech or my physical action or verbal action or even mental action, if I have hurt or harmed any one of you, I seek pardon from all of you. The intention was very clear. There was no intention to harm or hurt any one of you. But if it did hurt somebody, I seek your pardon. Don't carry any trace of hate or any anger. If there was something that didn't agree with you, leave them aside. You don't have to agree. Anything that was meaningful or you felt it was useful, just take them and integrate them in your life. Thank all the people who organized this retreat, giving me this wonderful opportunity. I feel so privileged, so honored to have got this opportunity. I once again thank all of you. All of you have participated, to have come and given a trial. Surely, no doubt, your life will certainly change for the better. Thank you once again.